Welcome to Real Crime Profile. I'm Laura Richards, and I'm director of Paladin and the founder of Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service, and also an expert on risk assessment and domestic violence and stalking. I'm joined by...
Lisa Zambetti. I am the casting director for Criminal Minds. As you all know, if you listen to our podcast, we normally work with Jim Clementi, who is a former FBI profiler, but we have wrestled the mic away from Jim for this very special bonus episode because Laura had a great idea that we focus on something very specific that we found out about Nicole Brown Simpson.
Yes, I think it's quite important. You know, the other things I haven't been saying in Real Crime Profile is that I have reviewed many domestic violence homicides and conducted thousands of risk assessments with victims, but also family members, and I've looked at lots of diary entries as well, and I've also written reports for court. And you know, when you're trying to understand what's going on for someone, you have to look at multiple sources of information. So we decided to drop another special, a cookie on Nicole, specifically around the diary entries, 14 years of diary entries that she kept in a safety deposit box, and also just some of the letters that she wrote, two in particular, which Lisa will give a bit more of a context on. So we're going to take you through those letters and do a bit of an analysis on the content and around the process of how they were used too.
So yes, we have two letters here. Neither of them are dated, but they have been authenticated as being handwritten by Nicole. And one letter was read in the criminal trial, and the other letter was read in the civil trial, and they both are very different letters, and they led to very, very different outcomes. So I think we're going to focus first on the letter in the criminal trial.
So only one letter was actually allowed into evidence of a number that Nicole wrote, and the prosecution case, they'd actually put to, or for, on behalf of the prosecution, there was an 85-page documented dossier about the abuse that Nicole suffered. But much of that was not allowed into the courtroom and was ruled inadmissible by Judge Ito, which is fascinating, given that the defence managed to actually get one particular letter admitted as evidence, which was called the love letter. So they managed to get one piece that worked for their case, and the rest of it was disallowed on the basis that it was hearsay.
Right. So they wanted it both ways. They didn't want any evidence of any bad notes about OJ.
Bad character.
Right. But they were totally fine with not calling this hearsay, which is a love letter to OJ. So we're going to read through the letter, and Laura's going to tell us what we really should be paying attention to.
So the double standard is set, and certainly the defense team, the scheme team, as Marcia called them, allowed, you know, one piece of information in that fitted with what they were trying to say. So some of the key things, and we will make sure that this is available on our Twitter feed as well.
And on our Facebook page, we'll post the entirety of the letters.
So we'll give you some of the bites from it. But it starts off with Nicole addressing OJ, that she would, "Dear OJ, I'd like to see you and talk to you in person, but I know you can't do that. I've been attending these meetings to help me turn negatives into positives, to help me turn and get rid of my anger. I've learned to let things go. I've learned that all the things that upset and bother me are just a mirror of what's going on in me. I always knew that what was going on with us was about me. I just wasn't sure why it was about me, so I just blamed you." So just from the start, there's certainly a tone that she is accepting all of the responsibility for what's going wrong, that it is actually about her and her internal conflict and problems, rather than it's about him. And I'm sure that he would have been reinforcing that much of this and his behaviour up until this point was because of what she was doing rather than what he was doing. Because she goes on to say that, "I'm the one who was controlling. I wanted you to be faithful and to be a perfect father. I was not accepting to who you are because I didn't like myself anymore." So here we have Nicole accepting the fact that it's her responsibility and it's her, that she's the one to blame, the fact that he's cheating on her with other women, and the fact that he's abusing her, but somehow she sees that it's because of it's the things that she is doing that evokes that reaction in him. Now, I certainly see that internalization amongst many victims, and particularly women who I work with. And when I'm risk assessing them, many times I'm hearing not the victim's voice, but I'm hearing the perpetrator's voice. The things that he has planted in the victim's head. And it takes a long time to erode that, to get to what the victim thinks and what the victim feels. And here she is saying that it's with her. She didn't like herself anymore. I'm not exactly sure what went on with me these last few years. I know New Year's Eve started it. And New Year's Eve, she's referring to a particular incident that she had documented. And we'll talk about the diary entries where she documents a serious physical beating at New Year's Eve at the hands of OJ. And she says, I sank into a depression that I couldn't control. I also agree with you now that I went through some sort of midlife crisis, that 30s thing, in inverted commas, you called it, my own self-esteem. I know it was a combination of all these things. I gave up treating you like I loved you. We started taking each other for granted and I didn't know how to put it all back together. But I never stopped loving you. I stopped liking myself and lost total confidence in any relationship with you. So again, she is just accepting all full responsibility for what has happened. And this is not uncommon by any means. And we hear that she really does want to put this relationship back together at the cost of and compromising, not wanting to argue with him anymore and trying to manage his behaviour in the best way that she knows.
So in this next part, I really needed this time in my life. It allowed me to get to know and like myself again. It's given me a chance to go from a non-person the past 3 years to a whole person.
But when she got together with OJ, she did have self-confidence and self-esteem. But somebody who's with the person that they love, who's cheating on them constantly and name-calling and breaking them down and being physically abusive, because we will contrast it to what was really going on at the time, the fact that she's saying that she felt like a non-person, all these things are not surprising given what was going on in the relationship dynamic and the things that he was doing to her and saying to her. And I certainly don't believe that this is a 30s thing, in inverted commas, a midlife crisis. Yeah. This is how he has dressed it up to force her to take responsibility for his poor behaviour.
But, I mean, how twisted is that? That you somehow you think not wanting to be punched and kicked and beaten is part of a midlife crisis. I mean, that you should be okay with that.
Absolutely.
And accept it.
But know. He would be saying to her, it's because she's feisty, it's because she's... And by all accounts, people did say that she was fairly ballsy and feisty. Mm-hmm. And he would be using that and saying that it's because she does these things that he behaves in such a way. And if only she would change her behaviour, then he would change his. And that's what she is giving a nod to and a signpost to here.
So she goes on to say, I want to put our family back together. I want our kids to grow up with their parents. I thought I'd be happy raising Sydney and Justin by myself since we didn't see too much of you anyway. But now I want to be with you.
So, and this part's important too. When certainly we see clients and victims who are with somebody who is abusive to them and they have children, well, the key overriding thing is that they want to be with that person, they just don't want the abusive part of them. And of course, she loves her children, she wants the family unit to be back together. It certainly talks to the fact that we didn't see too much of you anyway, so the sense that he's off gallivanting and doing his own thing and she's the one keeping the family together, and it probably went through her mind that if they weren't together, then would it have huge repercussions? But there's that part of her, I would say, from reading this, that does still love her, love him. Mm-hmm. And we see that in many, many cases where they still love that person, they're still emotionally connected to that person, even though they're being abusive, they just want them to stop the abuse. And that's what all victims have in common. So, and that's really what Nicole is articulating here.
Yeah, this next part, Laura, you talked to me about this before, before we started recording, about kind of idealizing the beginning of a relationship, and that image is so strong that that's what you're trying to get back to, you know? And so, do you want to read this part? Or?
Yeah, so okay. She says, I want to be with you. I want to love you and cherish you and make you smile. I want to wake up with you in the mornings and hold you at night. I want to hug and kiss you every day. I want us to be the way we used to be. Mm-hmm. There was no couple like us. I don't know what I went through. I didn't believe you loved me anymore and I couldn't handle it. Well, I mean, it's kind of outrageous, even the fact that, you know, I didn't believe that you loved me anymore and I couldn't handle it. She couldn't handle the fact that he was cheating on her left, right and centre. And that's the part, you know, for her, fidelity was an important thing. For him, he's cheating on her, but he's holding her to ransom and her to blame for the fact that he basically is having relationships with other women. But she, again, is taking responsibility. And she says, for the last month, I've been looking at our wedding tape and our family movies, and I can see we truly loved each other, a love I've never seen in any of our friends. Please look at the two tapes I'm sending over with this letter. Watch them along and with your phone turned off. They're really fun to watch. So she's hinting back to that those early days right. when they were together. And
it must look like a fantasy to her when she watches the wedding. I'm sure it was like a fairy tale.
Yeah, before he was probably abusive in the sense of he may well have always been controlling, but this is the time, the honeymoon, when things were good. And she's giving a nod back to that. And that's how she wants him to be again, for him to be non-abusive. And she's hankering after the OJ that she first met. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, that's not the man who she is with.
Right. She continues, OJ, I want to come home. I want us all to be together again. We can move wherever you want. We can stay here. I just never want to leave your side again.
Yeah, so we know that she has left a number of times, because she also goes on to say, I've almost come home 20 times since I've left, and that she had left before. And it does take women on average about 7 times to leave an abuser. But she's trying to say to him, you know, things will be different this time. I will change my behavior.
Yeah, whatever you want, whatever you need, I will do. You know, she's bargaining.
She is. Yeah. And that's the way she thinks she's going to manage his behavior. If she changes hers and she stops being the person that she is, then that will stop him from being abusive and they can return back to the couple that they were when they first got married. The next part's quite interesting, though, when she says, please watch the tapes. I know you have major anger against me, but you owe it to your kids and to us. I had that same anger. I'd never let this happen to us again. So the fact that she acknowledges that he's an angry person towards her, all of this is about transference, but she's still, there's a part of her that understands that there's this anger that she just cannot calm within him. But she's trying to deal with her issues, and she's hoping that in some ways that will change him and he will again go back to that person that she first met.
And Laura, look at that line, just jumps out at me. I'd never let this happen to us again. So she's, again, taking responsibility for his anger, for his...
She is, and we see that a lot. You know, if only I'd plumped the left cushion rather than the right cushion, and if I'd plumped the left cushion, then it would never have happened. So we see that the whole way, unfortunately, through the cycle of abuse, and it is a roller coaster where, you know, at different times, you've got the honeymoon period mm-hmm. where people apologise and they say that they're sorry, the abuser, and the victim definitely wants to believe them. She's going to try and do everything to ensure that this time it's going to be different. She'll be the perfect wife. She also says that, you know, she doesn't give a hoot what anybody else thinks. I only know I love you and our kids would be the happiest kids in the world. So she wants that picture perfect. And unfortunately, she knows that there is an angel demon with him, that it can be good. And when it's good, it's very, very good. And when it's bad, it's very, very bad. And there's not much in between in terms of this particular relationship. But this is her last attempt in some ways to try and calm the waters or soothe the waters, to take responsibility and to try and get this relationship back on track, whatever it takes. This letter, you get a sense that she's willing to do whatever it takes.
I'm going to take this part, this last part. OJ, you will be my one and only true love. I'm sorry for the pain I've caused you, and I'm sorry we let it die. Please let us be a family again, and let me love you better than I ever have before. I'll love you forever and always, me.
So she's desperate to get the relationship back together.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, it's not unusual to see a letter like this or a victim, you know, back and forth, like I said. And certainly it's interesting that the scheme team used this letter to show that actually Nicole was in love with him. Mm-hmm. They were happy. There was this side to their relationship. And probably to connect it to the OJ, I call it almost the confession letter that went before he went on the run, he writes the letter and he actually posits within that letter that he was the abused party. Yeah. He said that she controlled him. Mm-hmm. And so these are some of the threads that the scheme team pull together to try and paint a very different picture of what was going on.
Yeah, it's kind of victim blaming.
Totally victim blaming. And it's a complete epistemic imbalance, as I call it. I know that's a big word or a big phrase, an epistemic imbalance. But when you take one piece of evidence and you use that, so this one letter versus the 85-page dossier, which is documented and full of abuse of her diary entries, and you use this one particular letter and you use it to say this was the state of their relationship, that she loved him, that she admits by her own admission in the letter that she's controlling. Mm. But unfortunately, you're not hearing the victim's voice in this, you're hearing the perpetrator's voice in this. Right. And this is where you would absolutely want an expert on domestic abuse and violence against women and girls giving expert testimony about the cycles of abuse and about victims and how they behave, and also about perpetrators and how they behave and the patterning of that behavior.
Well, they did have an expert. This is kind of an odd situation, but Dr. Lenore Walker, who is an expert on domestic violence, was called in to testify. And I believe at first she was supposed to testify for the prosecution, but actually she testified for the defense. And she spent about 25 hours interviewing OJ and with another therapist, and then wrote an opinion about it. And at the end, when she testified, it was clearly in his favor. So how does that happen, Laura?
Well, it's an interesting thing. I mean, certainly, you know, the first thing to say is that when you do expert witness testimony, that you are there as an expert, and you could be called by the defense or for the prosecution, and you are there to give an objective opinion based on the facts, based on the evidence. So that part I cannot fault. She could be, you know, called by either, and she should be just giving her evidence and on her key area of expertise. But my problem in terms of the context of this evidence with it, and it's incredibly concerning to see, is that she wasn't an expert in particular in this area of a battered woman who's been, or a battered wife who's been murdered. Her expertise was much more in battered women who then kill the perpetrator. And unfortunately, some of the things that she said was taken out of context. And certainly in terms of some of the assessments that she did, one assessment in particular with OJ Simpson himself, she spent a number of hours with him and with a social psychologist assessing him. I think it was 40 hours interviewing him and doing one-on-one testing of him. And she, according to Cochrane, says that she found no evidence of antisocial personality disorder. But this isn't her area of expertise. She's not a clinical psychologist in that sense of working with and specialising in working with offenders. She actually works on the psyches of, you know, abused women. So it's quite concerning that her expert testimony was used in the way by Johnny Cochrane, who actually said that his client did not fit the profile of a killer, where I would absolutely disagree with that.
They should have asked you.
When you understand the patterning of all the historical context of abuse that had gone on. And in fact, one of my heroes, someone called Gavin DeBecker, who's an expert in risk and threat and domestic violence and stalking, who wrote a fantastic book called The Gift of Fear, also made a very strong point, which I totally agree with, saying that we're not talking about battered women syndrome here, we're talking about murdered wife syndrome. So we're talking about two quite different things. And unfortunately, what Lenore Walker had found was taken out of context. And the fact that Walker basically says that before a battered woman kills, there's normally a life-threatening violence that precedes a homicide incident, which she didn't find in this case. Well, of course she didn't find that in this case, because Nicole was killed. She wasn't the one that did the killing. So again, it's taken out of the context within which Lenore Walker's expertise actually sits.
Yeah, and that's incredible to me that the prosecution couldn't find a better witness than this. I know I have read that Marcia Clark met outside of court with an expert in domestic violence, and maybe she thought that that's all she needed. I don't know, but it seems kind of incredible. A lot of people testified, witnesses testified about seeing the abuse, her sister and her friends, but she didn't have that slam dunk expert on her side.
No, well, they had the 85-page dossier of documented abuse, that most of which was not allowed. Certainly, I have written reports for court, and one in particular, because we knew that the judge and the jury would struggle to understand why the victim stayed with the perpetrator. Mm. And that the perpetrator would probably make the case, the defendant that was charged, that they, in fact, were the victim, which is what we see more often than not. Mm-hmm. And it was almost, a case where it was saying, yes, I admit to manslaughter, but it's because she forced me to do it. So we had to, for my part, I was basically, my report looked at the domestic violence and abuse cycle in particular. Then I looked at the victim's behaviour and how they went back a number of times to the perpetrator, and the war of attrition got so great that every time she left, the stalking wore her down and she ended up going back to him. And then I overlaid it with the perpetrator's behaviour and the way that he behaved, and then I overlaid it with risk and what we know about the risk factors. So you can do it in such a way that you construct a narrative to show exactly what was going on. And it's a very similar case in many senses to this particular case. Mm-hmm. However, we know that the defence outgunned, sorry to use that term, but did outgun 5 lawyers taking on the prosecution, meant that they were coming at it with so many different layers and tools that unfortunately we didn't hear from an expert placing this in context, that this was all about the cycle and pattern of abuse, and that's a very context and narrative within which she was murdered.
Yeah, it just strikes me that at that time, Nicole's own words were considered hearsay. I mean, that's just incredible to me. And luckily, since this trial, actually the law has changed, according to what I've read. And now if a diary entry is about physical abuse or some kind of abuse to a child, that it can be admitted and is not considered hearsay. So at least that's something. So shall we turn to the next letter?
Yes, I think the next letter is very much in keeping with the 14 years of diary entries that Nicole mm-hmm. made. But if we take the letter first of all.
So this letter, again, was able to be admitted to the civil trial. They were able to read it aloud in the jury to hear it. And I think it made a big difference. Which letter do you think she wrote first? And I don't know how we can figure that out because neither are dated.
Yeah.
But the letters are so different. It's like almost like a different person wrote them. But
and this is important to acknowledge, that abusers aren't abusive all of the time. And so abusers can be, I call it the angel-demon dichotomy. So, one minute they're putting the victim on the pedestal, they love them, they want to be with them, they're saying all these good, things about them, and they want to get back together. But when the victim doesn't do what they want them to do, then they can turn into the demon. And, they start threatening and they use coercive control to try and keep somebody controlled. And it's exactly the same roller coaster that's mirrored in the victim's behaviour. When there's abuse, when they're being physically violent, you may then have a standoff period where neither party, maybe the victim, leaves, but then you get the perpetrator saying, I'm sorry, I didn't mean to do that.
Yeah, I wanted to ask
I'm
you.
I'm put this back together. It won't happen again.
That they try to make up for it in such dramatic ways, whether with jewelry or a car or something, that the victim is almost rewarded for being a victim. Like for letting herself be victimized and forgiving and moving, moving on or moving back in.
It's more the fact, really, that in any relationship, you have good times and bad times. But in abusive relationships, they are at polar ends of the spectrum. So when they're bad, they're really bad. And a perpetrator will know how to win a victim back, which is why it takes 7 attempts to leave. Mm. And it's not normally about rewarding a victim. It's about saying and doing the things, using the levers, pressing the buttons to get that victim back to them. Mm. And victims, our clients, they want to believe that it's going to change. They want to put this relationship back together. They fell in love with this person for a reason. And if they were abusive all of the time, they never would have fallen in love with them. So the abuser uses power and control tactics all the time. So it's whatever means the most to the victim. So it could be the children are used, threats that they're going to take the children away, threats that they won't see them again, threats around money. It could be giving them gifts. Whatever it is that are the sort of vulnerabilities around the victim, that's what the perpetrator will use, as well as the fact there is an emotional connect. And we mustn't forget that, that there was something that drew them together in the first place. And that's why in the first letter we hear that the defence used, the love letter, that, you know, she did fall in love with him and she wants it to return to that relationship right at the start. And I've certainly worked with women who've been with someone for 10 years plus, and for the first 6 months there was seemingly no abuse. But thereafter, it's abusive for the 9 years and however many months. But what they're saying to me is that they want the perpetrator to return to the person they were the first 6 months. And if only they did this, then the abuser wouldn't be abusive. He really treated her and saw her as his ownership, his possession, his property. And, you know, for Nicole, she struggled in so many ways with this relationship and felt very isolated and very alone.
Okay, so let's read this letter. Let me start. Yeah. OJ, I think I have to put this all in a letter. A lot of years ago, I used to do it much better in a letter, and I'm going to try again now. I'd like you to keep this letter if we split so that you'll know why we split, and I'd also like you to keep it if we stay together as a reminder. There you go. Right now, I'm so angry. If I didn't know the courts would take Sydney and Justin away from me if I did this, if I fucked every guy, including some that you know, just to let you know how it feels.
So what she's saying here is effectively that he would no doubt have used the children against her, saying that he would hire the best lawyers and he would make sure that she wouldn't see Sydney and Justin again. So the children are being used as a lever, as a weapon to keep her in situ. And she's also giving a clear indication that he was cheating on her, and that we know. And that if she had done the same thing, you know, she wondered how that would be, because there seems to be one rule for him and a totally different rule for her.
Right. I wish someone could explain all this to me. I see our marriage as a huge mistake and you don't. I knew it went into our relationship before we got married. I knew after 6 years that all the things I thought were going on were. All the things I gave into, all the, I'm sorry for thinking that, I'm sorry for not believing you, I'm sorry for not trusting you.
So again, these are the things that she understands that things weren't right and that she had cause not to trust him. But when she's challenging him or querying it, he's basically putting it on her that it's because she's untrustworthy, that she has issues, that it's the fact that he's using it to mask his own behaviour.
You're so paranoid, what do you, you know, just all that undermining.
Exactly. And sometimes when people are cheating on their partner, whether it's abusive relationship or non, they start to accuse the other partner because it's the very thing that they're doing. And it's kind of a distraction and a noise technique. But unfortunately, in this instance, it was just eating away at her confidence, her self-confidence and her self-esteem. But he was just throwing it back on her, that it was her behaviour that was creating the problem.
I made up with you all the time and even took the blame many times for your cheating. I know this took place because we fought about it a lot and even discussed it before we got married with my family and a minister. Okay, before the marriage, I lived with it and dealt with it mainly because you finally said we weren't married at the time. So I guess that's okay. Like, he could cheat because they weren't married.
Exactly. And that's what she's saying. You know, and so she struggled with that. Fidelity was a big problem for her. You know, that she, as in the sense that she wanted them both to be faithful, but he was making excuses all the time. Well, we're not married, therefore it doesn't count.
Right.
But he's not respecting her belief, her faith, how she feels. He's not respecting her right from the start. And this is why, you know, when we understand abusive patterns and cycles of abuse, that it doesn't normally start out with physical. It normally starts out with these psychological things, the undermining, the kind of making excuses, the doing things and pushing boundaries and disrespecting, but placing that on the victim and not taking responsibility for it. And that's exactly what we're seeing here.
Okay. You want to skip any parts or just keep going?
Where are we?
So I assumed that your nasty attitude...
That's really important, that bit.
I assume that your recurring nasty attitude and mean streak was to cover up your cheating and general disrespect for women and lack of manners.
So again, this is a clear insight into his mindset. She talks about his nasty attitude and mean streak. So the fact that, you know, he was doing things that, you know, were upsetting to her, the name calling, and we'll hear a little bit more about that in her diaries. But certainly the fact that she says that she thought it was a cover-up for the cheating that he behaved in that. But the disrespect for women, I mean, this is exactly what I would expect to see here, that there were some attitudinal issues around how he saw women and whether he saw them as objects, i.e. that she belonged to him. And we certainly heard about that in court, where one of her sisters said very clearly that he would grab her by the crotch in front of people and would say derogatory things to her. And he clearly saw her as his possession. He was entitled to her. He owned her. But actually, that this was objectification to women, full stop.
I remember a long time ago, a girlfriend of yours wrote you a letter. And she said, well, you aren't married yet, so let's get together. Even she had the same idea of marriage as me. She believed that when you marry, you wouldn't be going out anymore. Adultery is a very important thing to many people. It's one of the first 10 things I learned in Sunday school. Some things you learn at Sunday school stick, and the Ten Commandments did. I wanted to be a wonderful wife. I believed you that it would finally be you and me against the world, that people would be envious or in awe of us because we stuck through it and finally became one, a real couple. I let my guard down. I thought it was finally going to be you and me. You wanted a baby, so you said, and I wanted a baby. Then, with each pound, you were terrible. You gave me dirty looks of disgust, said mean things to me at times about my appearance, walked out on me, and lied to me.
So, oh my God. Pregnancy can be a high risk factor to serious harm and homicide. And it's interesting, she says quite a bit about when she was pregnant, that this is when the relationship dynamic shifted, that he would be derogatory to her, that he made her feel terrible about the fact that she was putting on weight. And there's a bit more to be said about what was going on when she got pregnant. But this is real insight here into how mean he was to her and how it was really eroding her self-esteem and her self-confidence.
I gained 10 to 15 pounds, more than I should have with Sydney. Well, that's by the book. Most women gain twice as that. It's not like it was that much, but you made me feel so ugly. I've battled 10 pounds up and down the scale since I was 15. It was no more extra weight than was normal for me to be up. I believe my mom. You thought a baby weighs 7 pounds and a woman should gain 7 pounds? I'd like to finally tell you that that's not the way it is. And had you read those books I got you on pregnancy, you might have known that. Talk about feeling alone.
So we hear not just about how he's behaving in pregnancy towards her and that he's cheating on her and that he's saying these things that she should only put on 7 pounds because that's baby weight, but she also talks about isolation, you know, and how alone she felt. And when women are pregnant, they have huge hormone issues going on as well. They need support.
Certainly do.
They need to be, you know, not cosseted, but looked after. There are lots of things going on for them. But here we have somebody who is just all about them, being very narcissistic and egocentric and nasty and mean and making her feel terrible about herself.
In between Sydney and Justin, you say, my clothes bothered you, that my shoes were on the floor, that it bugged you. Wow, that's so terrible. Try, I had low self-esteem because since we got married, I felt like the paragraph above. There was also that time before Justin and a few months after Sydney. I felt really good about how I got back into shape. And we made out and you beat the holy hell out of me. And we lied to the x-ray lab and said I fell off a bike. Remember?
Great for my self-esteem, she says after that. So, again, he's just on her the whole time. And this is the thing around coercive control that we've talked about. But where her space and her actions are being limited, that she is the person with the problems, not him. And even the fact that, yes, there was a serious incident and she has to lie, so she colludes with the abuse. And no doubt that would be used as a lever. Well, you lied before, so who would believe you now? And no doubt he would be saying these things, whispering in her ear to completely undermine her.
Right. And this incident was documented in several places, including by the doctor who examined her and didn't believe the story that she had fallen off a bike. But that information was not admissible in the criminal trial, although it did come out later.
And there was a positive report strategy within California at the time. And actually, you know, as we have now in many medical professions, they should be asking the right questions about what's going on. Mm-hmm. Because victims will go in there and they won't give the true story about what's happened. They may be, even be stood there with the perpetrator. So getting them separated and asking the dash questions, the 15 high risk factors at the very least. And of course, this is back in time now. But there was a positive report process. So this should have been absolutely on the radar. She also says, you know, great for my self-esteem. There are a number of other incidences that I could talk about that made my marriage so wonderful, like the televised Clipper game and going to, it's illegible the next bit, but before the game and your 40th birthday party and the week leading up to it. But I don't like talking about the past. It depresses me. Then came the pregnancy with Justin, and oh, how wonderful you treated me again. I remember swearing to God and myself that under no circumstances would I let you be in the delivery room. I hated you so much. And since Justin's birth and the mad New Year's Eve beat up. And she then goes on to talk about, you know, I just don't see how that compares to infidelity, wife beating, verbal abuse. I just don't think everybody goes through this. And if I wanted to hurt you or had it in me to be anything like the person you are, I would have done so after that incident. But I didn't even do it then. I called the cops to save my life, whether you believe it or not. But I didn't pursue anything after that. I didn't prosecute. I didn't call the press, and I didn't make a big charade out of it. I waited for it to die down and asked for it to, but I've never loved you since, or it's never been the same since our wedding, when she took her vows. And just that paragraph there, the fact that she's saying, you know, she doesn't believe that other people go through this sort of thing, and that she didn't, she only called the police because she felt he was going to end up killing her. Mm-hmm. She's trying to protect herself and keep herself alive, but she's also still trying to manage him by saying, you know, I didn't call the media in, I didn't make it a big deal, and I'm not going to. And unfortunately, this just emboldens him further, the fact that she hasn't spoken up and out about it at other opportunities. So unfortunately, his confidence increases that he can continue to get away with it, and for her, she feels that there's no escape.
I think this particular incident that you were just reading is the one time that he was arrested, and I think the cops were quoted as saying, you know, he's like, you've come out 8 times, why is this any different? Why are you arresting me now? So this was, it seems like a really big deal in their relationship that he probably tormented her about time and time again when he was arrested.
And this is probably the thing that they're talking about later on, the thing that she did, and now, you know, when she calls the police later again. So I think, you know, for her, she's dealing with so many things at one time, and she's trying to sort of say, well, I never did make these things a big deal, but the way that he was treating her was unacceptable, and she's trying to lay it down in a letter, because no doubt whenever she expresses an opinion that he undermines her, or it's when things start to turn physical. I mean, certainly just talking about the that she didn't talk to the media, she didn't prosecute. You know, silence, unfortunately, only colludes with abuse and the abusers, and it's only them who benefit from it. And many victims don't speak out due to fear, shame, humiliation, and fear. You know, for her, this is fear again, that she doesn't want to escalate things. She doesn't want to make him angrier by speaking to the media, by prosecuting him, but she's in a no-win situation. And I genuinely believe that it's the reason why she started writing the diary entries, because she knew, and she was prophetic, that he would end up killing her one day. And these are very clearly clues that she's leaving behind about the state of the relationship.
Absolutely.
And we see that all the time, why, you know, certainly in London, also over here, you know, why some victims go to the police and they report an incident, and they're reporting it because they know they're at risk, and this is kind of the evidence trail that will be left as and when they're killed. And I have to say, having reviewed hundreds of domestic violence murders, in most of the cases that I've reviewed, the victims said that they were going to be killed. Sometimes they said how they were going to be killed, and then that's exactly what happened. And then we sit around a table reviewing the murder, or it's being investigated, and it goes to trial, and everyone wonders how the victim knew. And it's because they are experts in their own situation. And when they believe that they genuinely are at risk, as Nicole did, on one of the incidents when she calls the police in her own account, as soon as they arrived, she ran into their arms and she said, he is going to kill me, he is going to kill me. She genuinely believed that. And we heard on the 911 her absolute fear that was in her voice.
So let me just read the very last part of this letter. I just believe that a relationship is based on trust, and the last time I trusted you was at our wedding ceremony. It's just so hard for me to trust you again, even though you say you're a different guy. That O.J. Simpson guy brought me a lot of pain, heartache. I tried so hard with him, I wanted to be a good wife, but he never gave me a chance.
And I think that's the key part, that the marriage certainly did change when she had children, and it does change when, you know, there are babies in the house, and you cannot have that same lifestyle. And that's what she's saying, that she couldn't be the party girl. She had wider responsibilities to the children, and that was the thing that he again lorded over her. Mm-hmm. And she wants to be the perfect wife. She wants to please him, mm-hmm. and she feels that she's falling short on everything, no doubt because of what he's saying to her.
And I bet, especially in their community, such, you know, wealthy community, everybody looks perfect, everybody has the perfect house, the perfect car, the perfect body. I mean, there must be an extraordinary amount of pressure and a very high standard.
I would have thought so, but it's, you know, she was a beautiful woman. Mm-hmm. She had a fantastic figure, mm-hmm. and he just used every vulnerability that she had. So it's no wonder that she felt so insecure, that her self-confidence went, that her self-esteem went. Any person in that situation, when they're expecting to be loved and cared for and looked after by their mm-hmm. partner, when they're feeling most vulnerable, the thing that he does is actually use those vulnerabilities against her. Mm. And that's when we see the true signs of an abuser, is that when the victim, in terms of the power dynamic, when the victim is feeling at their most vulnerable, that they seize that and use it as an opportunity to exploit the victim further. And that's the dynamic we see, along with, you know, if we talk about just some of the high risk factors just from that letter alone. So bearing in mind that we would look at that sort of letter and we would sit with a client or a victim and talk to them about what's going on, we would ask the dash questions. Mm-hmm. And the ones that I drew out is that, yes, there's absolute fear, and she's terrified and terrorized by OJ. There's isolation, coercive control, the way that he wants the house done, the way that he wants dinner on the table at a certain time. Mm-hmm. He has prescribed rules for her in terms of how she should behave. He has prescribed rules about how much weight she should put on when mm-hmm. she's pregnant. These are rules that are set by him. And when she doesn't abide by those rules, that's when he starts to become more controlling or becomes physically abusive. There's excessive jealousy. He talks about her having affairs and being with other men. Pregnancy and new birth, that's a time when we see abuse. It's normally when victims start to talk about it. They may not have talked about it before because they're now concerned about the risk to their child. Mm-hmm. But it's when the attention tends to be focused on pregnancy and, you know, having a child, and it comes off of the abuser, and that can destabilize
things. So she's of course, giving her attention to her child, and I'm sure that can make him very jealous.
Indeed, and the fact that she's getting bigger and fatter, and he's using that and kind of calling her names. Separation, every time she leaves, it heightens the risk. And for him, he's desperate to get her back. So he starts, you've got child contact issues here, and she talks about the children. But you've also got threats to kill, and she genuinely believes that when he makes a threat that he will kill her. And mm-hmm. she talks about that. And certainly when you get somebody who's stalking somebody and they make a threat to kill and there's been an intimate relationship, one in two, half of those perpetrators will act on it. So this is where we saw violence, abuse and threats, and certainly strangulation, escalation. We hear a little bit more about some of the diary entries where we hear more about the financial abuse, weapons being used as well, and we hear about rejection and finality. And those two things are also, in terms of the continuum to murder, are really important things that we risk assess and understand. So the diary really gives an insight and holds a mirror up, mm-hmm. as does the risk assessment, from Nicole's perspective, to who and what OJ was really like.
So what do you think, Laura, if this material had been allowed in the criminal trial, do you think it would have made any difference? Or were they just at the time kind of tone deaf to the whole issue of domestic violence? Would hearing it in her own words, in her own voice, seeing that laundry list of attacks that she has in her diary, which we can also post on the Facebook page.
Of 11 specific incidents, when we know that there would be many more across the 17 years. Mm. I mean, for me, you know, one of the biggest challenges in this case was that it was not presented as a domestic violence murder. And straight out, that should have been the context. This is a domestic violence homicide. And bringing in the right people, experts, to talk about the dynamics of abuse, to lay that out right from the start, to also, you know, and in many senses, we know that the scheme team turned it on its head. They made it a trial about race. They made it a trial about LAPD, which made sure that Nicole and Ron were a footnote, even in their own murder trial, which is extraordinary that they did that. But, you know, we've covered all the contextual things. I mean, Nicole was seeing an advocate, and I think it's interesting what the advocate said. You know, I would have been calling that advocate, to a domestic violence specialist, to talk. And her advocate was somebody called Lisa Foe. And she said something that was very interesting, which was, without appropriate intervention and consequences, abusers continue the violence and it escalates. And I absolutely agree with her. Mm-hmm. If you don't close down the space, the abusive space that a perpetrator operates in, it just means they become emboldened. Mm-hmm. And without real-life consequences, as in the things that they fear, that there are genuine consequences for their behaviour, they would just carry on doing what they're doing. And the prosecution did, in fact, say that when OJ beat her so badly and when he was arrested, that he was, he basically received an outcome which was effectively counselling over the telephone for what he did.
Oh, yeah, he dictated all the terms for that. I mean, he got to choose what charity. He got to make the excuse that he couldn't be there in person and it had to be over the telephone. I mean, it was hardly any kind of consequence for him at all.
No real life or real world consequence. I mean, the media and other people, and why Nicole talks about that in her letter is because he cares about his public face.
Right.
That's the thing that he would have been bothered about. So shame him for what he was doing. Mm. And for Nicole, in terms of giving her the right information to leave safely. Now, I don't know those conversations between the advocate and Nicole, but if she were working with me and my service, Paladin, we would be trauma-informed and we would be talking her through all the safety options, giving her the right information so that she can make an informed decision about leaving. Mm-hmm. But Nicole, and this is an insight to her of what she said, was that you never do anything about him. This is what she said about the police. The police never do anything about him. They talk to him and then they leave. Mm-hmm. So she knows that every time she's calling, no one, they're not asking the right questions, but more so, they're just letting him get away with it. And we know that when people keep getting away with it, they just continue that behaviour. And as Lisa said, they continue and they escalate. And then something like this happens. But this case should have been prosecuted as a domestic violence murder in the context. And that was a really important part to bringing this case to trial. So let's say a little bit about the diaries. I mean, Nicole kept her diaries for 14 years, and these were diaries that were kept in a safe place, so she kept them in a safe deposit box, and I think it was her father that held the key to it. And it was very prophetic what she said. And like I said, like I see in many domestic homicide reviews, it's not that they're predicting their murder, it's that they know where their perception, they're the person that understands the perpetrator the most, and that's why we ask them about risk and their perception of risk, and it's really important when we are assessing these cases. But she in particular lists, and this is something that we will post online, 11 particular incidents, and of course there were probably many more that were undocumented. But the first one, I believe, happened by her account, she says, very early on in the relationship, actually, in 1978, the first documented attack. And she said it's the first time, it was after a party, and that OJ had called her a whore and had hit her whilst making her have sex.
Right.
So here we've got another potential risk factor, if we believe what she's saying, which we have no reason to doubt it, sexual abuse and sexual violence was something that I would have expected to see here, purely because he is so entitled, basically treating her like she is a possession and like he owns her. And so there are other examples where she said about another particular incident, "You beat me up, OJ. I won't live my life wondering where the next beating is coming from. You had better get used to the fact that I'm not your property to use and abuse the way you see fit. It's over, OJ. Accept it and leave me alone." So she very clearly understands that he treats her as property. Mm-hmm. And there's finality here. And I genuinely believe, having worked with thousands of women who are abused, there's normally a trigger incident before a homicide, that she had said that night that it was finally over. I am not allowing you to continue this abusive pattern of behaviour. I'm not your property. This is over. And that rejection, along with Paula, was the trigger. She does talk about the financial abuse. And it was, interestingly, she and the children who were moved out of Rockingham.
Right, right, right.
Now, where in other cases, you know, you normally see it's actually, you know, keep the children in situ. Mm-hmm. And it's the male in these kinds of situations who may leave so that you don't disrupt the children. But actually here he's talking about money and he's using money as a lever to no doubt keep her controlled because she hadn't worked. And he knew that that was something that he could use to keep her controlled. So financial abuse normally goes hand in hand with coercive control. She was a stay-at-home mum. But certainly, you know, you could call this these diary entries, the 14 years of them, the OJ file. She was collating her own dossier on him just in case something happened. And she said very clearly that he just would not leave her alone. He would not accept that she was trying to leave. And that this would continue and continue. And, of course, every time she's calling the police, you know, she says it by her own admission. They never do anything. They just talk to him and then they leave. So she was stuck between a rock and a hard place.
Right. It does amaze me that when she lists all the things that he did, I mean, he shoved her out of a car and left her. You know, he would beat her right before they would be going in to see friends. I mean, he just... Anytime, anywhere, he could do it, he would.
He took a baseball bat to her in a car, and he ripped her clothes off her in one incident where he ripped her top and her trousers off, and she talked about that, and the New Year's Eve party where he beat her so badly on the bed until the police came. Mm-hmm. But I genuinely think, you know, again, from having analysed her entries and what she says and the material that's available... For her, the psychological abuse was far worse. Mm. You know, this erosion of this beautiful young woman who, by everybody else's account, was fiery and ballsy and strong. And that's probably what attracted him in the first place, to him then wanting to undermine her, unseat her, control her, keep her guessing all the time, and using physical abuse and sexual abuse when he couldn't get his will by using all the other forms of abuse, of verbally trying to knock her down, of using the children, using threats, and that he would use physical when those other tools weren't working for him. And that rejection and that finality, those triggers in context, tell a story on their own. And that night, she had made up her mind. It was final in her head, and I'm relatively confident that she would have had that conversation with him.
Mm-hmm. I don't know if this is on topic or not, we can cut it, but I wanted to know your opinion about the males in his life, because we've talked a lot about how her friends, some of them knew, but they didn't take it seriously. I mean, is he surrounded by men who also are turning a blind eye and who, or...
I think lots of people...
How do men react to that when they have a friend who is obviously violent with their wife or girlfriend?
Well, I think if we just take this in context of that, you know, you've got the perfect couple here. You've got a beautiful young woman, Nicole. You've got a handsome sports star, and they get together and they are very good at hiding what's going on behind closed doors. You know, Nicole had lots of friends and her sisters, and everyone said they missed the warning signs. So, and that's why we say behind closed doors. Mm-hmm. And Nicole was very good at disguising things. Mm. She didn't want people to know what was truly going on, how lonely, how upset and how isolated she was, how the marriage was a sham in many senses. And OJ carried that off too. And the silence allows him to carry on in this way. So no doubt many people did not know what was genuinely going on here. They saw things, but they put it down to isolated things, not a pattern of behaviour. And I have to say, I mean, I've analysed and I've profiled many perpetrators. I've talked to many perpetrators too, and they don't have a sticker on their head saying that they're perpetrators. Mm-hmm. They can be charming, they can be disarming. So for me, charm disarms. You know, when people are overly charming, it always raises an eyebrow for me. OJ was one of the smooth-talking, you know, very charming, very plausible, having listened to his interviews. I even found myself, you want to believe him. Yeah. He's got an answer for everything. You want to accept his version of events. You want to like him. He's got the likability factor and all these things weighed in heavily. And Nicole probably well knew that who would believe her. It was her word over his. And she had a lot to lose by talking out about it. And even calling the police, it takes a huge amount of courage for a victim to call the police. And I mean courage, but it's also, it means that there's serious fear levels there, that she was fearful for her life on multiple occasions. No one wants the police rummaging through their life.
Mm-hmm.
And this would have been her absolute, you know, the last lifeline that she can call upon. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately, the response in every situation where she calls the police just was not adequate. And we know that this was back then. So, you know, I give that context to it. This was some time ago from now, that our knowledge is much more sophisticated. We've got far better tools. But who would believe her? Who would take her seriously? Yeah. Even though there were photos showing what was going on, even though when she goes to the hospital and she's having bones x-rayed, no one's asking her the right questions. And all of that, those things just collude with the abuser and to keep her silent and keep her in situ. And I feel, from listening to what the family have said, listening from what people around them have said, that they did not know what the warning signs looked like. No one threw a lifeline out to Nicole. And I always say lifelines come at very funny times. And I've had victims disclose to me at very odd and peculiar times. Mm. They test people out to see whether they can handle it. They test people out to see, is it safe for me to tell you?
Yeah.
And what you say back once that line is thrown out is the difference between someone disclosing what's going on and someone closing down about what's going on. And it can be a very subtle thing. The choice of language and the way that you ask questions or the way you respond to a victim can have a profound impact on what they say and do next. No one was listening to the things that she was saying or asking the right questions. And that, again, is exactly why the DASH is such an important risk assessment tool developed by myself with other professionals, but also heavily influenced by victims. Road tested and used many times, and in London there was a 58% reduction in domestic violence homicides for the very reasons that the right questions were being asked.
Yeah, it's funny that when you said charm disarms, on our show on Criminal Minds, we have different categories of killers, and some killers look like killers and look damaged and deranged, but then we have a other category in casting that we call charm and harm. So you're looking for a guy who you would never think butter would melt in his mouth. You know, the all-American guy who has some serious rage against his victims. So,
and this isn't about serious rage. This is about control. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see with abusers. And charm can be used to control.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you think about it on just a very basic level, if someone pays you a compliment, you're much more likely to rate them on a likability scale positively than you are negatively. Mm. And abusers know this, and they use all the tools and tactics that they possibly can to control and manipulate. And that's what OJ does. He's very good at manipulating, incredibly narcissistic, says the right things, can work people, can work a room, and he's very skilled and averse in it. And you know, I still will throw out there that killers do not have killer tattooed on their head. You know, when people say, oh well, he was a nice person, he was great to me, you know, maybe that's so, because abusers are not abusive all of the time. And if we brought a group of them in here now, they would sit down, be able to have conversations with us, and they would interact. Some of them would hold court and tell, you know, great stories and
charismatic
center of attention.
Oh.
And these are the people that, for me, hide in plain sight. Mm. And part of the risk assessment tool is about weeding out these people that are high risk, that can switch and turn the lens on the victim, because that's what they do. They discredit the victim, just as what we saw with the scheme team, where they call Nicole every name under the sun, and they use it to show her in a light that she was the abuser and the perpetrator. OJ is the victim in all of this, and they switch the trial out into something completely different.
Mm-hmm.
Very clever tactics. OJ had the money to do that. I've seen it happen many, many times, where it's the victim that then is held up and questioned about their credibility. And the abuser, of course, knows every weakness, every vulnerability, and they exploit it and they use it for their own purposes. And that's exactly what went on here. But Nicole's diaries speak from the grave, as do her letters, and they give a very clear story. You know, why would she make these things up? She had nothing to gain by doing that, but everything to lose, and she paid with her life.
Mm. Well, Laura, thank you so much for your microscopic analysis of these letters. It's really eye-opening for me, and I hope for you guys out there too. Thank you all for listening, and also for all your great comments on Twitter and Facebook. Again, we wanted to do this bonus episode for you, and Jim unfortunately couldn't be here to do this, but I'm so glad that the women of Real Crime Profile have taken the mic. And anything else you want to say, Laura?
Yeah, I just want to say one thing, book recommendation. If you're interested in not just this subject, it's domestic violence, stalking, Gavin De Becker, The Gift of Fear is a fantastic book.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing to say is that domestic abuse and stalking, these aren't women's issues. Mm. We need men to be part of the dialogue. We need men to, your question about what were the men doing, we need men to call out abusers, to say that it's unacceptable. This could be your sister, your mother, your daughter, the next generation going through this. And we want people to be talking about this, and we want men to be part of the solution. So it's not about alienating. So this is a women's issue, and that's why Lisa and I are talking about it.
Right, no.
It's mainly down to the fact that Jim's schedule and diary is just so busy that we're trying to fit this in and amongst all the other things that we're doing. And this is the only time we could get together. And we all feel that this is a really important cookie to add to, into the podcast, that we explore and explain things in much more detail. And we will get into Ron as well. You know, the victims should not be a footnote in this case. It should actually be about honouring their lives and learning from their deaths. And that's exactly what Nicole's family wanted to have happen. And I absolutely want to pay credit to them and carry on that really important work and showing insight and detailed analysis and what it can tell us. And hopefully more people will start talking about domestic violence and stalking and making it a conversation that people can join, and are stamping out abuse and violence and controlling people and calling them out on it and holding them to account.
All right. Thanks, you guys.
Thank you. Bye.
For advice or support, if you're experiencing stalking in the UK, you can contact Paladin National Stalking Advocacy Service on 0207 840 8960 or go on the website www.paladinservice.co.uk. If you're experiencing domestic violence, call the National Domestic Violence Helpline free phone 0800 2000 247. In the US, if you're experiencing domestic abuse and need advice, shelter, safety or counselling, call the Genesis 24-hour hotline 214 946 4357 or go on the website www.genesisshelter.org, or you can call the National Domestic Violence Hotline on 800 799 7233.
Real Crime Profile is produced and edited by Paul Francis Sullivan, engineered by Jacob Moose Molin. Music is composed and performed by Simba Sumba. Logo art by Rob Cohen. Real Crime Profile is produced and recorded at Empire Studios LA by XG Productions.